From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of The Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to this month's episode of Sending the Clowns with my excellent co-host, who's now taking everybody by storm, none other than Dave McGowan. Dave just released and is sending out his latest book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. So I guess the hippie dream was more like a hippie nightmare. Hey, Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Maria. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, for everybody out there that's probably going to panic because there are fires in Sedona today. Sedona is a good distance away from me, so just pray that the wind changes into the opposite direction.
There's big fires in Sedona today?
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, look at San Diego. I mean, you know, we're in drought. You know, people in Texas are drinking, in some towns, they're drinking toilet water. And, you know, they got 32 or 34.
My parents don't live too far from Sedona, actually. They're in Prescott Valley.
Well, supposedly it's in Oak Creek and burning up towards Oak Canyon.
I don't really know the area all that well.
Right, but, you know, listen, Arizona's dry as dust, same as every state out here.
Here it's ridiculous. There was actually a fire that started right in the Big Tahunga Wash, which is just two blocks from my house, just a few days ago, and the fire department responded in force with, like, six fire engines and a couple helicopters, and they got it out like immediately before it got anywhere. But they're not taking any chances around here at all.
Right.
But, this area is just ripe for a wildfire. You know, we've had some really, really bad ones come through here in years past, and this year, I mean, the conditions couldn't be more ideal. It's just, I mean, everything is just bone dry. It's hot. Windy. It's everything a fire could wish for.
Right. I know. And all the dried foliage, which when it sits on the ground, it's like gasoline just waiting for a match. But it's interesting because I was talking to one of the firemen that works out with me at my gym about the fires in San Diego. And, you know, he agreed with me because I said to him, you know, you can't put out a chemical fire with water. I said, and with all the chemtrail spraying, those trees and everything is covered with chemicals. And you know what? He agreed. So it wasn't any big surprise to a fireman.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's, I mean, everything here is just brown and dry. And the winds have been blowing really hard, like bringing the big tree branches down. So there's all this dead, dried wood that, you know, it hasn't been cleared out. And
I know. We've had lots of wind here, too.
It's not good. It's not a good situation at all. And, they're keeping a very close eye on any sign of any potential fire starting up because it could spread so fast. It'd just be devastating.
Absolutely.
Keep fingers crossed, knock on wood, and all that good stuff. And
all right. Well, let's get over to your book release. I see you've been doing quite a few interviews.
I have. You know, this feels kind of like being back home, you know? Like I've been on like a few week road trip and now I'm back home, you know, on your show. Because I've just been getting just inundated with interview requests. I mean, way, way more than at any time. I mean, I've been more probably in the last few weeks than I probably did in the previous, like, 2 years. I mean, it's just, yeah, I just did 2 hours with Jim Fetzer on Monday, and now I'm, you know, here with you today. I got another one on Friday with the Opperman Report, and then a brand new one on Tuesday that I just agreed to yesterday. He wanted to do it this week, and I'm kind of talked out this week, to be honest.
Right. I know.
I need a little bit of a break.
I totally understand.
So now I got that one going on Tuesday with some guy in Hawaii who was tipped off to my book by a pharmacist in Maui or something, who he said just raved about it. And so it's generating very positive word of mouth so far, as near as I can tell. And, you know, my faithful fans have flocked to Amazon to post reviews, and it's gotten a couple of online reviews that are very positive, and it's just a whole weird situation, because I'm not used to my work being praised so much, you know. It's yeah, where's all the haters? I know they're gonna come out soon. I mean, they haven't yet, but it can't be long, you know.
Maybe they're just too cheap and don't want to buy the book. Because, you know, it's always the ones that don't do the research.
I mean, it's just been a whirlwind of activity. And, you know, I got 2 personal appearances signed up for next month, which I first time that I've done that in like 13, 14 years, which I'm actually a little nervous about, because public speaking has never really been my strongest suit. But I'm very excited about it, to get out there and meet some of these people, you know, after all these years, people have been following my work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been so supportive for all these years. And, of course, it's limited to, you know, L.A. people, but...
Well, but who better than people in California to read this book on Laurel Canyon?
Yeah, and one of the appearances I'm really excited about, which is at Book Soup, which is literally right on Sunset Strip, right between the Whiskey A Go-Go and the mouth of Laurel Canyon. I mean, it's just right there where it all happened. So, I mean, I couldn't ask for a better venue. And, just really excited about, that it seems to be still being very, very well received so far. You know, the Amazon reviews have been very positive. The word of mouth I've heard have been, you know, very positive. The online reviews that have gotten, you know, everything,
Right.
Yeah, it's all a little overwhelming. And
well deserved.
And yeah, it's kind of crazy. Everybody seems to want to talk to me.
Well, you know, that was an important time period in America's history. You know, so you're going to have a lot of boomers, you know, that are really interested in it. I remember when we started that series on the show, how many of my listeners were writing in saying, "You're ruining the 60s music for me." But everybody was still all into it. You know, I got some notes this morning because I posted you coming on about your book today, and got some notes, you know, from some of my own listeners who already have the book, already read the book, and are all thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, people just can't seem to get enough of it, you know. I'm kind of worried that maybe the book's not going to be enough.
You might have to do a sequel.
You know, the whole time that it was an online series, people were just like, give me more, when's the next chapter going up, you know, and they just couldn't get enough of it. And now, you know, it's now been packaged into a book and lots of new chapters and all that, you know, and I'm just thinking, God, I hope this
well, you know, you and
I'm already getting requests for a sequel.
That's what I'm saying.
I got a couple emails telling me I needed to, I'm like, a sequel? I just put 8 by 7 years of work into this damn thing. Barely got it on the shelves, and now you already want a sequel. Wow.
Well,
so,
maybe, maybe somebody.
it's all very flattering, but it's just a little overwhelming.
I know, because I know you, and it's really out of your comfort zone to do all those things.
It is a little bit, you know.
I know.
It's been, and I mean, I just, you know, some of the things that people have said about the book have just, you know, been some of the most, you know, flattering compliments that I've ever received about my writing.
That's great.
I mean, some of the nicest compliments that I've ever received about anything that I've ever done in my life, you know. you know, people have told me that it's very addictive. You know, several people have said that, you know, basically once they started reading it, they couldn't put it down. You know, they just...
That's great.
They just fell into it. And even a couple of the people that I had, and I recruited quite a few people to help me with the proofreading and editing, you know, getting feedback from people. And like two or three of the people that I asked to, you know, help me with that, told me that they had trouble doing it, that they had, because, you know, when you're reading something as like a, you know, proofreader or editor, you got to kind of be able to detach yourself from the material and, you know, read it in a, just on a sort of a technical level.
Right.
You know, looking for, you know, misspelled words, grammatical errors, typos, continuity errors, whatever, formatting errors, anything that, you know, anything that's just not quite right. And you got to kind of detach yourself from the storytelling element. And, you know, two or three people told me that they had a really hard time with that because they kept getting caught up in the story and they'd reach a point where they'd be like, oh, shit, I stopped being a proofreader like 15 pages ago. And then they'd have to back up, you know, to where they left off. And they said that they kept having that problem, you know, throughout. And which is, you know, I mean, really... I couldn't ask for a greater compliment than that, you know,
right.
for people to be.
Well, you know, so, maybe this will also interest people in checking out your other books.
Well, hopefully, you know, because, you know, I mean, they never really had any real, you know, promotion or, you know, marketing muscle behind them, you know, and so hopefully maybe this one will, you know, lead people back to, you know, some of my past work and, so we'll see. We shall see. But so far, it seems to be going very well. And, you know, as I've told a couple other people, it's just night and day from, you know, the last book I published, the last few, you know, the last three books, which were all, you know, 10 plus years ago. And, you know, those just kind of arrived on Amazon just sort of set there, you know. There was no fanfare, there was no advance buzz, nobody was chomping at the bit to buy it, you know, and it just sort of quietly arrived and just sat there for years. I mean, literally years. Took years.
Right. Well, now you can clock it on Amazon.
And now this one just right out of the gate, you know. I mean, I don't really know what to make of it in some ways. This one has more Amazon reviews and more positive reviews in like 3 weeks than like the F Word does after 13 years.
Yeah, but let's not discount that F Word book because that was freaking great. I refer to it a lot on the show. And that's how I met you. That's when we got started.
Probably so, yeah. And yeah, I think it's passed up both of my first two books and it's closing in on Program to Kill in a number of reviews. And Amazon just opened the review section on, I think, like May 1st or something like that. So
that's good. Well, maybe somebody
yeah,
will.
I mean, I prodded some of my fans to, you know, to get some early reviews in there because, you know, it's a huge. I mean, that makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll have to make sure to go in and do a review on it. But, you know, I just got my copy this week. And I looked at it, and I thought to myself, Dave, I said, how many years did we do shows on Laurel Canyon?
You know, oh, my God.
It had to be over a period of at least 3 years, maybe more.
At least, probably more than that, probably off and on for like 5, I would think.
Yeah. Right, and then I said, and here it all is in one book, yay.
Yeah, and so yeah, and you know, I mean, and the unfortunate reality is that we, you know, live in a world where brick and mortar bookstores are more and more, you know, disappearing from the scene, and you know, Amazon is the place where most people shop for books, for better or worse, and you know, they don't have the benefit of being able to actually physically pick up the books and look through them, and you know, see what
right.
you know, so.
Are they gonna...
What do they have to go on? They have a, you know, a picture of the cover and, you know, the author's reputation if he has one, which, you know, to most people I'm completely unknown. Mm-hmm. And you have a brief synopsis of the book and you have feedback from other people who've read it, you know? So, I mean, those, those Amazon reviews are really a crucial tool these days for, you know, reaching a wider audience, for better or worse, you know. I mean, I'm not happy that a lot of people shop on Amazon, but that's the reality of the world we're in, you know. And
is the book going to come out?
I mean, it's horrible what bookstores have to deal with these days, you know. I mean, I've been in a few of them recently, you know, trying to set up book signings, and you know, the guy was telling me that, you know, how hard it is for them to survive these days as independent booksellers, you know. And he said they have people come in all the time that just use their store for browsing.
Right.
You know, they'll browse the shelves till they find what they want, and you know, he said some people are kind of discreet about it. They'll just sort of browse around and then leave, and then they go home and log onto their computer and order the books that they just looked at through Amazon, you know? But he said some people are just really brazen about it.
Right.
They'll do it like they'll do it like standing in the store in the, you know.
Well, I mean, but I think that's true for any retail business.
You know, they'll
find
a book on the shelf that they like, pull out their smartphone, pull it up on and order it from Amazon while they're standing in the store looking at it on the shelf, you know, to save $5 or whatever it is, and then walk out of the store without buying anything. He said they even have a name for it. They call it showrooming or something like that, where, people just come in and kind of just use the bookstore to browse and then order everything online to save a few bucks, you know? And they don't realize that by doing that, they're putting that store that they, you know, that they use for that purpose, they're ultimately putting that store out of business.
Right.
You know?
Well, but you know what? I mean, you can't fight
that's the reality of the world we live in now with smartphones and all these apps that can, you know, find you the absolute lowest price on, you know? And,
right.
You know, it's
well, look, retail can't compete with the internet, because when you buy something online, you don't have to pay the retail store's rent and electricity and all the other crap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, all the overhead and, the rent and the employee cost and, you know, everything else, I know.
Right. Well, you know, I have my own thoughts on e-books, too. I think what they want to do is switch everybody over to ebooks, which is okay if you think about it. I don't want to read anything online or on any gadget because my eyes are shot by the end of what I have to do every day on the computer. But think about this, Dave. Think if all the books available were only available in ebook form, and then the lights go out. It's better than the burning of the library at Alexandria to get rid of books and education for people.
It's a scary thought to me, because I have heard, in fact, I have read in the news that there's been cases where they've like recalled books, so to speak, you know, and where basically a book that was on, you know, they can just pull it back.
Right.
You know, you used to have this book on your Kindle now, or your whatever these things are called, and now it's not there anymore, you know. And, you know, if they can do that, then I'm sure they have the technology to if they can remotely remove content from your readers, then I'm sure they have the technology, or will soon, to remotely edit the content on your, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, once all books are ebooks, they can pretty much write history on the fly, you know?
Exactly.
Yes. As they go, you know, I mean, all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, didn't this book used to talk about...
Right, but think about if the lights go out, everybody's screwed, because, you know, they're closing so many libraries throughout the country, because people just don't have the interest anymore to have a real book in their hands.
I know.
We'll have a very dumb society, is the way I see it. So I always like real books. People pitch me for the show. I tell them, if you have a hard copy book, send it to me. If it's ebook, I'm sorry. I'm not reviewing your book. And that's just the way it goes. It's too much for me. I can't spend any more hours online than I do. Anyway, maybe they'll come in at you with a movie offer on this book. You'll never know. You can be the producer.
You never know. I mean, who knows, you know? I mean,
I can say I knew him when he wasn't famous.
I don't
famous.
See it happening, but, you know, there could be foreign language editions, you know. I mean, there's possibilities, you know, of where it could go. you know. So yeah, the ebook, I'm sure the ebooks are selling really well, and you know, I mean, I can see the attraction. You know, it's like $10 or something like that on Amazon, and
right, and you don't have to carry a book.
$9.99, $10.99, and you get instant gratification. You know, you pay your $10 and you're reading within minutes. You know, rather than paying $25 and waiting for a week for the book to arrive. You know, so I understand the appeal, but. It concerns me, you know, that it's, you know, killing off the, you know, real physical books, and it concerns me that it gives the government vastly greater powers to, you know, for censorship, you know, electronic remote censorship.
Right, Well, anyway, let's get back to your other work, because I think you got another book in the making. You might as well write a Lincoln book, since everybody else is writing a Lincoln book. I went back to your site and noticed you had three new chapters up on the Lincoln assassination. And when I started the one I think you wrote in mid-April, I went, what? Because I never even knew this. You writing almost at the top of the article about John Wilkes Booth and who really was he. And I had no idea that he was also a rapist till I read this. And I'm like, what?
Accused, yeah, he was quite the ladies' man. I mean, he got around, and there were a couple of incidents that you don't read that much about, but they show up here and there. Where, yeah, one of which was involved a woman who reported him for rape in what was it, like Philadelphia or something like that, I think, and. The other one was a case where he got his ass whipped pretty badly, apparently, by an irate, jealous husband of one of the women he was courting, because he had a lot of girlfriends, apparently. He was a very, he was like the Brad Pitt of his day, or the, you know, Johnny Depp, or I don't know, whoever the, you know, the young heartthrob in Hollywood is these days.
Alright.
So yeah, he got around. I mean, he was, you know, he had a good life, you know. That's one of the things that doesn't make sense about, you know, the whole, you know, he wasn't some loser, he wasn't some guy that had nothing to lose. He was a guy that had a lot to lose, you know. He was wealthy, he was famous, he was loved by men and women alike, you know. He had women just throwing themselves at him, basically, you know. And I mean, he wasn't really wanting for much in his life. And,
He threw away a lot.
If he actually did what we're to believe he did, you know, he threw away a very lucrative career and a very, you know, a life that, you know, most guys would kill for, you know?
Right. Well, wasn't his father also quite the ladies' man as well?
What's that?
Wasn't his father quite a ladies' man too?
Yeah, his father was. His father actually had two families, which wasn't known for a long time. That he had actually married this gal in England, where he was from originally. He was originally English stage actor, very popular, and he married this gal, and they actually had a couple few kids, but only one of them survived. And then he basically abandoned them and sailed across to America and took up with his other gal, with whom he had like, they had like 10 kids or something.
Right,
like that.
Wasn't John Wilkes.
Never told his other wife that he had basically started a new family. I mean, he kept her in the dark for years and years, you know, basically, you know, telling her that he was just, you know, making a living in America as an actor, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of communication across the ocean.
Right.
So, you know, he was sending her money and whatnot, and it wasn't until years later that she came across and confronted him and found out that he had a whole other family.
Wow, 10 kids.
A wife and this woman who was passing, who he was passing off as his wife, and a whole slew of kids. And he eventually divorced that first wife. And then did marry this gal, but only like a year before he died. And, you know, the kids were all like mostly grown or at least teenagers and stuff by the time he finally married this girl, which was quite scandalous, you know.
Of course, in those days, right?
In those days, that this guy had two separate families on opposite sides of the Atlantic, you know.
Right.
And wasn't from each other.
Wasn't John Wilkes Booth the ninth child of that second brew, and wouldn't that make him a bastard?
See, they were all of them, all of the kids that we know of as Booth's kids. The only one that was legitimate was the one that nobody's ever heard of that was born in England. All the ones over here that went into the acting world, Junius Brutus Jr., Edwin, John Wilkes, all the sisters, they were all illegitimate kids. John was one of the youngest, and I think he was like 12 or 13 or something before the two actually got married. So, yeah, all of the kids, all of the ones that we know of as the Booth kids were born out of wedlock.
Now, wasn't John Wilkes Booth
bastards, as they would have been referred to back in those days, yeah. So
wasn't he and his father both accused or spoken of as being spell casters, that they actually cast a spell on people they met and everybody, like, fell for them?
You'll definitely find accounts of that in the literature, yeah, that John Wilkes Booth had a... But, yeah, he could pretty much give, you know, I mean, people just really loved him and wanted to please him. And, you know, he was just a wildly popular guy, very charismatic, very persuasive, apparently. And, there are quotes from people that knew him that say, you know, I mean, everybody that met the guy fell under his spell, you know.
Well, maybe they really were spellbinders, because wasn't his father a member of that Hellfire Club that Ben Franklin was a member of, too, and Aleister Crowley?
It was several generations back. His namesake, John Wilkes, was a member of the Hellfire Club with Ben Franklin during that, whatever year that was, that was like the 16, I don't know, wait, what year that was, late.
I don't really remember, but,
something like that.
Yeah, but wasn't there a lot of Freemasonry, wasn't that set up by the Freemasons, and a lot of satanic stuff with that Hellfire Club, basically ran like a whorehouse?
Yeah, basically, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of talk back then about what they were involved in, and they had like this sort of this cave network of caves where they held secret rituals, and you know, there were all kinds of allegations of, you know, ritual sacrifice and satanic black masses and orgies and, you know, just all kinds of all kinds of debauchery, and it was pretty openly rumored, you know, back then that they were involved in all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of just touched on, and I want to say it was probably the piece you put up in April, you kind of just touched on or blew over something about Ben Franklin and his membership at Hellfire Club, which I've covered before when I was talking to somebody who did a movie about the Freemasons, that 10 bodies were found in the home that he had there.
Yeah, you remember reading about that?
No, I read it on your thing, and I was like, what? What's this? And I meant to ask you, more info, please.
Yeah, that surfaced like, I want to say like 5 years ago, when they were doing some renovation on this house, which is, I think still kept as like a historic landmark or something. It's the house that Franklin lived in while he was there. I think he was serving as like ambassador to the UK or something. I don't know what his title was at the time, but he lived there for quite a number of years, and that was the period during which he was involved with the Hellfire Club and with all these other prominent people that were involved in that. And yeah, I think it was like 5 years ago. They were renovating the home, and they found a bunch of bones, human remains, in the basement of the house. They said it was at least 10 bodies, a lot of them kids, and they were carbon dated. And it was determined that they had in fact died, and the bones dated from the exact period when Franklin lived there.
Oh.
And the cover story that's been concocted is that he was living with some other guy who was like a medical student or something to that effect, and that this guy was probably, you know, like robbing graves or like performing home autopsies, basically,
right.
You know, to further his knowledge or education or whatever, and, you know.
Right.
Completely innocent, of course. Yeah, I mean, illegal and definitely frowned upon in those days, you know.
Right. Sounds like a cover for sure.
Thing. But that's kind of the cover story that's been concocted, is that, oh, no, it wasn't Franklin at all. It was this other guy that was living there. And, you know, Franklin probably didn't even know about it. And if he did, then he would have just had his own scientific curiosity about it, but wouldn't have seen it, you know.
Yeah, but he was exposed.
It's all been spun.
Right.
No, it's perfectly normal that
right.
the fathers of our country should have the remains of Ken Bond
right.
in his basement. That's totally normal. That's
right.
You know, he shouldn't draw any weird conclusions from that.
Right, but it is pretty well known that Franklin was quite the party animal. He loved going over there to the Hellfire Club. There's so many quotes about him. You know, I'm trying to think of the name of the producer, because I'm sure I still have that show in my archives on the Freemasons.
He was also considered quite the ladies' man.
Well, he was a big whore master, right?
Quite a persuasive, you know, charismatic guy that, and John Wilkes, too. And these guys were not, like, real good-looking guys.
No, they weren't.
For the photographs, there were first people believe.
Yeah, they're pretty gross.
You know, these are guys that look like ladies' men, but yet they definitely had a reputation for, you know, having a way with the women. And basically, you know, women were just putty in their hands, so to speak.
Yeah, well, maybe they were casting spells on them because, you know, listen, Franklin was no good looker, okay? So it wasn't like he was so handsome you were going to fall over him in the street. You know, one thing I have to tell you, these last three chapters on Lincoln and the photos you have of, you know, Wilkes and all these other players, all I could think of were the photographs you pre-posted about the supposed assassins and the group of assassins and how handsome they were and how ugly these people are. I was like, is this a war? Did they, like, set these guys up because they were handsome and these guys are, like, barking dogs? It was just a thought, Les. It was just a thought that came into my head looking at these pictures. I mean, all right, Junius Brutus Booth, all right, he's not too bad, but, you know, he kind of reminded me of the Errol Flynn family without the good looks. And I'm like, oh, my God, what a bunch of dogs. And I remember, because we commented so much about how handsome and those Hollywood headshots of all the supposed assassins. And I said, I wonder if it was because they were good looking and these guys were ugly that they decided to make them the patsies. More women for
those
them.
Those guys were pretty funky. I mean, the face, some of the facial hair, the sideburns, and the just these bizarrely overdone, you know, these elaborate mustaches and sideburns and mutton chops and what. Some of the facial hair, really, you look at it and go, really? That was considered an attractive look in that day?
Facial hair. You got Lord Mayor of London, John Wilkes, and obviously his, whoever painted his portrait, tried to do a nice job of the fact that obviously the guy's cockeyed. You know, he's cockeyed and he's got this wave of hair that doesn't appear to be growing out of his head. And I'm like, oh, my God. And you look at his hand. He's got a hand of a woman. I mean, there's nothing attractive about this guy. And these were the lady killers of old. I was like, wow, I'm glad I wasn't living at that time.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at more modern, you look at a guy like Henry Kissinger, who always had gorgeous young women on his arm.
Well, that's money talks, because there's no, believe
you know,
me, they wouldn't have enough money for me.
Hardly fit the profile of a ladies' man, you know?
Oh, yeah. What kind of ladies?
Yeah, you know, you gotta wonder, you know, I mean, part of it's the money and the power, you know, women are attracted to money and power, but I don't know, I think it may go a little beyond that.
I don't know, I'd have to take a pass on that one, and so far as I know, I'm all woman. Okay, Dave, we're gonna take a short break, but when we get back, it wasn't just the fact that this John Wilkes Booth, it was an actor and, you know, a lady killer and everything, but there's another side of him that very few people ever talk about. So stay with us, Dave and I. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to Sending the Clowns. As you can see, Dave and I are having a couple of good laughs. We even had a couple of good laughs during the break. But before we get into some other interesting things Dave was talking about, because of what I led to before the break, one thing people don't talk about when they talk about the Booth family in general is their deep, close ties to the power structures in Washington and London. And they still are today. And I got to tell you, as I'm reading this story, Dave, when I see Teresa Booth's name and you say she is now the wife of Tony Blair, I was like, holy free, holy Batman.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, she is actually directly descended from Alphonsus Booth, Junius Brutus's brother, who was John Wilkes Booth's uncle. Teresa Cara Blair, which is she goes by Sherry Blair, is direct descendant. Yeah, her maiden name was Teresa Cara Booth.
Yeah, and I'm like, wow, this
direct descendant of the from the Booth family tree. Yeah,
what a coincidence.
And served you know, just what 20 years ago or whatever as the they call the first lady over there, first lady of Downing Street or something like that. You know, the equivalent of our first lady. And yeah, it's pretty remarkable that the direct descendants of the Booth family are still to this day find themselves in very prominent positions in the government.
Right. So when you see the connection, you know, when I read the connection between, you know, his connection to Washington and London, you know, the power structure, it made me think about Laurel Canyon. Okay. Because there's similarities, so it just seems like whatever field of life we're living in, we're still being ruled by the same people and the same duplicity.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, and, you know, some people have questioned what the relevance is of, trudging up the Lincoln assassination, and there are very clear parallels, and it makes you realize that, things maybe haven't changed all that much. Staging crime scenes may not have began with Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon, because there's every indication that the parallel attack that supposedly took place that most people don't even know about, that think they're pretty well versed on the Lincoln assassination don't even realize that there was supposedly a simultaneous attack at the home of the then U.S. Secretary of State, William Seward, in which a whole slew of people were almost killed, supposedly. The Secretary of State himself, two of his sons, his male nurse, State Department courier that happened to be there, all left near death, supposedly, and yet hardly anybody even knows about that aspect of the Lincoln assassination. It's generally either not mentioned at all or just kind of mentioned in passing, and none of the details are really provided, and there's a reason for that, because the deeper that I've been digging into it, the more it appears that it never actually happened. And, of course they didn't have, film crews and, reporters didn't have, they didn't even have still cameras, let alone, having like roving news crews. So they didn't have to actually stage it per se, but It certainly seems that it was just like completely made up, and basically they just sort of wrote a storyline and for something that never actually happened.
Well, you know,
as the series develops, I think people will definitely come to that conclusion as well. Because I mean, to me, the more I look into this thing, the more I think maybe that this whole, you know, parallel attack on Seward may be a key to understanding the whole thing. You know, because if that was all made up and staged in conjunction with the Lincoln assassination, then obviously it went well beyond John Wilkes Booth. You know?
Right.
So that's kind of the approach that I've been taking. You know, the more I get into this, the more I'm thinking, man, I think there's a reason that we don't know about the Seward thing.
Yeah, maybe it really never happened.
Maybe things aren't all that different today than they were 150 years ago, you know?
Well, you make it clear that, you know, they had withheld evidence, they fabricated evidence, you know, the same thing the LAPD does now.
Yeah. Oh, you know, speaking of the LAPD, by the way, did you happen to read the article that I linked to on the from the LA Times last week about the LA about the investigation of this alleged shooting at two officers? Did you happen to?
I don't know. I've read so many things; it's not hitting a bell.
Because we talked about it. I know you and I talked about it several months ago when it happened. There was a supposed incident where two LAPD detectives were actually pulling into the parking lot of one of the LAPD station houses, and supposedly some guy approached them and opened fire on these two cops in their squad car, and the cops returned fire, and there was just this massive police response, of course. They basically put like a whole section of the city on lockdown and rolled out the SWAT teams and the armored personnel carriers and the helicopters and, you know, the whole militarized drill type thing. And I said at the time, I said, this case just absolutely reeks, because the reason being is that it had come fairly soon after the Christopher Dorner fiasco.
Right.
Which was also a case of a guy, you know, supposedly deliberately targeting the LAPD or officers within the LAPD. And the way they responded to that was so far, you know, I mean, that was like all we heard or read about here in LA for like a week. Half the damn state was on tactical alert. You know, every department was fully mobilized, and, you know, it was insane. What they were doing to supposedly bring this guy to justice, because he posed such a huge threat, you know, because he had attacked police officers, you know. And then this guy comes along not long after, I mean, just like a few months after, I think, and supposedly attacks two, you know, is brazen enough to shoot up an LAPD squad car with two cops in it in the parking lot of the station. And yet after that night, you know, there was a report about the incident and about the police response, and then you never heard about it again. It was never mentioned again. They never revisited it. There was no indication that they were still looking for this guy. And I'm like, this has got to be bullshit, because they're not going to, you know, why would they just give up the, you know, they ran this drill, and then once the drill was over, they seemed to have completely lost interest in pursuing this guy, you know, and he's never mentioned again. So I just think this has got to be a staged event to justify this, you know, running this drill.
Right.
And then last week, tucked into the LA Times in the back pages was this article about that an independent investigation had been done, and lo and behold, there was no evidence that these officers were under fire at all. And, you know, the way they described it, it was basically like the LAPD's version of the Tonkin Gulf incident, you know,
right,
where Johnson famously was asked about later and supposedly said something about, hell, I don't know, for all I know, they were shooting at dolphins out there, you know, something to that effect.
Right.
And that's basically the same thing. This investigation revealed that there was no evidence that anyone other than these two officers had fired a shot. One of them fired 23 rounds And the other one, I don't know, like half a dozen. Between the two of them, they fired like 30 rounds. But every slug, every case, shell casing, everything we recovered from the scene was from their own guns.
Right.
And they shot their car up. Shit. Through all the windows out, just shot this car up like their own squad car. They shot up. And according to this investigation, there was no evidence, no ballistics evidence, no evidence from witnesses, no evidence anywhere that there was ever anyone involved other than officers.
Right, but when now we
have an independent investigation verifying that the LAPD did in fact take this incident, you know?
Right.
And the main officer involved, this is where it gets really good, the main officer involved was a former partner of the Fall Guy in the Rampart scandal. What was his name? Rafael Perez or something like that? One of the most infamously corrupt LAPD officers of all time. who took the majority of the rap for the whole Rampart scandal thing. And this the cop involved in his incident just happened to be his former partner who had been discharged himself for corruption way back in like 2000 and had then been reinstated and had been involved in a couple of controversial incidents since then. And now this just happens to be the guy who's at the center of this supposed attack on the LAPD. So the whole thing just absolutely reeks of being completely staged.
Right, but when you look at
this drill.
Right, but when you look at history, you're going all the way back to Lincoln, and you made a very strong case for pretty much the same thing. You know, confessions that were extorted. You know, conspiracies, they didn't interview the real eyewitnesses, they only interviewed, you know, people that weren't there, perjured testimonies, you know, withholding exculpatory evidence. I mean, everything was already happening back in Lincoln's day. That's why when Bush Jr. was president and he's passing the Patriot Act and, you know, all this stuff he's doing, I was telling my audience, he's not doing anything that Abe Lincoln himself didn't do all those years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they broke every rule of imaginable, you know, just blatantly coaching their witnesses, that, you know, suborning perjury from witnesses, paying witnesses, withholding their witness list, you know, I mean, just manufacturing evidence, suppressing evidence, introducing, you know, just blatantly irrelevant testimony that was designed just to stir the people up and you know, just, you know, inspire hatred of the, you know, alleged conspirators for stuff that there wasn't even alleged that they were even connected to. You know, they dredged up all these alleged Confederate plots to, you know, wage biological warfare and, you know,
right,
water supplies and deliberately starve Union prisoners. And, you know, they just dredged up all of these horrors from the Civil War that had nothing whatsoever to do with the case being tried and was just, you know, designed just to inflame.
Right, and what about the people, what about the fact that some of the people that got subpoenas to show up in court just ignored them and there was no punishment for that?
Yeah, President Johnson was actually subpoenaed, you know, to appear in court, which is, you know, legally binding, you know, which is supposed to be legally binding, and yeah, he just ignored it, and you know, the court didn't have a problem with that, and, you know, I mean, one of the indications is how ridiculously fraudulent this was, is that this went on for like 7 weeks with the prosecution just daily breaking every rule imaginable, and yet all the, you know, half a dozen or so defense attorneys combined only waged like, I can't even, 12 objections.
Right.
12 objections. Through 7 weeks of, you know, less than 2 objections a week. they were making as the state was just blatantly parading in fake witnesses, you know, witnesses brazenly perjuring themselves.
Prisoners.
Witnesses who had been paid for them. And then they set 12 objections throughout the entire proceeding, all of which were overruled, despite the fact that they were all legitimate objections and they could have made hundreds more. You know, so, yeah, the whole proceeding was just an absolute joke. It was one of the greatest stains in American history, really.
Well, it's kind of the way our courts work now, you know. It's not any different today. You look at Bradley Manning, you know. I mean, you know, you get an American now, and you don't get a civilian trial. You get a military trial, and wasn't this also a military trial?
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, they were all civilians, and the war had just ended, and the state had no legal right to resort to military justice, what they called justice.
All right.
And in fact, it was even ruled a couple of years later that the trial had been unconstitutional, not just because they were denied civil trials, but they were denied their right to individual trials. They were tried as a group, all eight of them together. You know, just thrown in, lumped in together in one big, ridiculous military proceeding. So they were denied the right to a civil trial, and they were denied the right to a individual trial.
Right, and well, pretty much denied a right even to an attorney.
They didn't even have their own individual attorneys. Several of them actually had to share attorneys with, it was just absolutely absurd what these people were put through that was, supposedly justice.
Right. Well, one last point, because we're running out of time. The photograph in the court, in the trial, of John Wilkes Booth wasn't even John Wilkes Booth. So it was one of his brothers. So what's that about?
Things I don't even know what to make of that. But yeah, it was uncovered that, within the files of the military justice, this photographic exhibit marked photograph of Booth, and it's a photograph of Edwin Booth, and which was apparently used throughout the trial. You know, is this,
that's him. That's the guy.
Which is just baffling. I mean, it's not like there was a shortage of pictures of, most people who lived in that era lived their entire lives without even being photographed, obviously. But John Wilkes Booth was not one of them.
No, he was an actor, of course.
There's a lot of photographs available of John Wilkes Booth. It would not have been very difficult for them to get one.
Well, maybe they wanted to mind control the people there, so when they smuggled John Wilkes Booth out of the country, everybody would have the vision of his brother in their head instead of what he looked like.
Yeah, on one of the wanted posters, too, I'm not 100% sure about that. I'll have to double-check. I haven't got to that yet. But, there were some very strange irregularities in the wanted posters as well, where their names were misspelled seemingly deliberately, that the pictures were of people other than them, or pictures that didn't really look like, that were atypical pictures of them, and it didn't, there was indications that they didn't really want these people, some of them at least, to be identified, so.
So it was pretty much a whole
very
sham.
Strange goings on.
Right.
There's so many aspects of it that people really don't know about. Even people in the conspiracy, community it's nothing like the Kennedy assassination that's been, parsed for 50 years now in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who know every twist and turn of the JFK assassination, but a lot of the aspects of the Lincoln thing have just largely been unexplored for a very long time now. And there's a lot of weird stuff in there.
I would think that makes your job a lot more difficult, because you got to try and find. I said that must make your job a lot more difficult, because you've got to try and find out information on stuff that happened 150 years ago.
It's fascinating. It's much different than anything else. It's such a change from Laurel Canyon, which was like in my lifetime and in my backyard to where I can,
right.
In 20 minutes, I can drive over there and actually physically look at the places where all this stuff happened, you know.
Mm.
And whereas this is, you know, many, many miles and many, many years removed. So it's quite a different project. But, it's fascinating. I mean, endlessly fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Reading the series on your site is pretty intense. So, everybody, there's a live link here, davesweb.cnchost.com. Go check out the whole series. Dave, I want to thank you so much and save your voice. I'm sure you got plenty of other interviews coming up on weird scenes inside the canyon.
A couple of days I've woken up like kind of hoarse, like I was like yelling at a rock concert all night or something.
That's how I feel after one news show. So welcome to my world. Well, Dave, take good care, and I'll go and review your book too on Amazon, and I guess I'll talk with you next month.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The more the better.
Absolutely. So. All right, kick ass, Dave. I'll talk to you soon.
You too. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Dave McGowan, one of a kind, that's for sure. And you know what? Who's had him on his show for 14 years? I have. Why? Because I loved his first book and I've loved everything he's done since. So if you can go all the way back like this to Lincoln's Day, trust me, everything we've ever been told in this country is a lie. And that's the way it goes. And I swear, if I had a time machine, I wouldn't even use it for myself. I would give it to Dave so he can go back there and dig it all up. Anyway, tomorrow I'll be back with the news. Thanks for supporting the show. If you have Dave's book and you've read Dave's book, why not go over and post a review on Amazon? It takes like 3 minutes. Anyway, thanks for supporting the show, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.